You're listening to a DM podcast.
Hi, I'm Nigel Marsh, and this is the Five of My Life podcast, the show where five choices reveal sideways insights into the lives, opinions, and lessons of interesting people. Michelle Stevenson has enjoyed high-profile success across a wide range of international media roles, perhaps best known for presenting the national news on radio in Australia for over a decade. This conversation was a delightful and thought-provoking insight into her own life and views. Our discussion covered topics as diverse as motherhood, the state of the media industry, mistaken identity, music festivals, and much more. So, Michelle, welcome to Five of My Life.
Thank you for having me.
Have you remembered any of your choices?
I had a brief look, because I got to be frank. When these choices are really quite complex and hard to think of, because of course there's a million things. And I was sitting around the dining table with my husband, and we'd had a few cocktails. And I was like, and it was funny because he kind of helped me, but he knew the things that I was going to say. Like I was like, yes, or I would say, and he goes, yeah, I would say that that's right. So, because I kind of just needed help. I'm getting old too. I forget stuff.
So it's been vetted.
Well, not vetted, but more like I needed a sounding board. I'm like, I think this is my favorite movie. He goes, yeah, I would say that.
So the guests, hilarious how they different approaches to choosing, the choosing process.
Yes.
So some keep it completely secret from their loved ones. And then they get in trouble because they don't mention, you know, their husband or their kids or whatever. They go, why? So I don't make the top five, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Mikey Robbins, hilarious, said to me, how about you choose for me and don't tell me, and then I backwardly justify live on air why I've chosen. I go, mate, that's not the idea.
No, but that is peak Mikey Robbins.
Debbie Does Dallas, Mein
yeah,
Kampf.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right,
exactly.
Now go.
Exactly.
Now, we start with the film on Five My Life, always. And you have chosen the 2014 Interstellar. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think, and you'll probably see this as well when we get to my book as well, I kind of like a dystopian idea of the world. Christopher Nolan is an incredible filmmaker. Like everything he does is pretty incredible. I mean, my son, who's 10, his favorite movie is Inception. So we're a big Christopher Nolan fan. This film kind of had everything. I mean, Matthew McConaughey was like incredible.
Easy on the eye.
I mean, he's not bad to look at, I'm not going to lie. But what really blows my mind, particularly with Christopher Nolan films, is the complexity around the story and that it's true. Like there's a lot of mathematics and, you know, what's going on in the universe, and it's all real. Like these things could happen and can happen. That kind of blows your mind. But then it's also that idea of Matthew McConaughey weaving his storyline in through the time. I think that's kind of what really got to me.
I found it, I just got the sense that maybe I wasn't understanding it.
Oh, really? So had you seen it before?
No.
Okay, that's interesting. Have you watched Christopher Nolan movies?
No.
Oh, wow.
So I sat down with my wife and watched the whole thing. It's not a short film.
No, I mean, his movies aren't, though. No. It's like kind of this whole idea of like a story within a story. Is it a dream? Is it real? But the mathematics of it all, I think, is what is quite incredible.
So explain.
The whole idea of like 10 minutes on a certain planet equals like 20 years for the person who's waiting on the ship. So like, and then that's real, that concept of time. Like all that stuff is kind of real, and it just kind of blows your mind. Like how is that even possible?
Now, you mentioned that there was a dystopian theme between your first and second choices.
Yeah.
And your second choice, the book, is A Boy and His Dog at the End of the World by C.A. Fletcher. I have a copy of it here in my hand. Now, this isn't the type of book that I would normally read.
Right.
Which is part of the joy of me doing this this show. So I read it and I bloody loved it.
How good is it?
Yes, it's really good.
It's one of those books that I give to people because I feel like it's a gift, like the way you read it. Because I work in news and as a journalist, I read every day. I'm obsessed with what's going on in politics and news and everything. So I'm across all that kind of stuff. So reading for joy, it's really hard to find that time. So normally my family and I, my son and my husband, we go camping for at least 2 weeks in January every year. And that's my opportunity to whip the Kindle out. And I read that book and it was just on the cusp of COVID coming through. And it really resonated with me, particularly the months afterwards, because COVID kind of in the beginning had a dystopian feel to it. The world was shutting down. This could, you know, all go to shit. Because yeah. That's quite, I mean, people were fighting each other for toilet paper. It was like, it was insane. So it was quite, it kind of resonated for a very long time for that reason for me. But I just think the way it's told is so beautifully done. And the twist, which I don't really want to give away in case anyone wants to read it, is just something you kind of, so you may not see. I don't know if you saw it coming.
So, gosh, I'm very tempted to give it away, but I won't, because the author says in the front of the book, don't. And as an author,
yeah,
I'd like to help authors. So that there are two twists.
Yes.
So here we go, talking code now.
Okay.
So the first one, I just couldn't care.
Right.
It's a twist. You go, okay.
Yeah.
The second twist knocked me on on my backside.
Yes.
I thought, wow. Yep. Oh, go away. I didn't see that coming. I didn't see either of them coming. But the setup of the book, I'd loved all of it, but I found the first 40 pages where they were describing the end of the world as we know it, you know, down from 11 billion people to 8,000.
Yes.
But the wonderful way the world ended with a whimper, not a bang. Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
So no one can have kids.
Yeah.
So it's not like a big nuclear bomb.
No, they just faded out.
Isn't that great?
Yeah,
well, not great. Horrible.
No,
but isn't that a great
just
concept?
The lines stopped going. But yeah, and I think also when the protagonist goes through to chase the dog, because, I mean, we're not giving anything away. The dog gets stolen by a thief and he's chasing his dog. He wants his dog back. But when he goes through, like, you know, kind of walking through what's left, the remnants of cities.
Yeah, great, and stuff descriptions.
Like that, the descriptions were, and you could visually see them. Like, this is a book I could see in a movie. But this whole idea of the world coming to an end and what happens really kind of, I mean, when COVID happened, I was like, let's buy a plot of land. Let's bury some shit in the backyard because, like, it's coming.
So it makes me want to ask you, are you a worried soul? Did you worry about the end of the world? Because your film choice and your book choice is all about the end of the world? No?
No. I'm not worried about anything, really. I always feel like the world will find its balance at some point. I don't fear what is going to happen around us. I fear the reactions of the people. I mean, COVID in some respects and a lot of these big sicknesses, I think, are part of a cleansing to help the earth continue on, because we can't keep overpopulating. Otherwise, what's going to be left?
Yeah. Tell me about your love of the news and how you consume it and what that does to your daily mood, because it's not always beer and Skittles.
No, and I think especially because I work in radio news, I read news, so it changes and it's breaking news and it's happening on the hour. Basically, I take the shit that the world has to offer and I shine it up a little bit and give it to you in bite-sized pieces of information in what I think you need to know. But that can be, at times, very, very distressing. And there have been moments where I've even spoken to my therapist about it where, you know, I have to, before I walk in the door to see my family, I have to go into my bedroom and sit for a second. It's also the reason why I watch Real Housewives and reality TV. So I can just sit there at night and watch pretty people fight over dumb shit. Like,
right.
The news can really take on a real burden after a while. And there have been some tough stories that I've had to cover, like the downing of MH17, which had this Perth family, like they lost all their children and her father on it. So, you know, there's been some stories that you just, particularly when you have a child, before that you're kind of in the frame of if it bleeds, it leads, and you don't really think of things from a humane perspective. But as soon as you have a child, it kind of changes your perspective on how you view things, and you view them in a more empathetic way.
Have you ever read, it's called How to Lose Friends and Alienate People?
Yeah.
There's a wonderful story in that where he's working in, I think it's for Tatler or something, that would work for the story. And there's a horrible domestic plane crash.
Mm.
And in the newsroom, you know, a plane goes down over Idaho or someone and 213 Americans.
People get excited.
Well, it's sort of worse. So people were excited. And then the exchange that he puts in the book is, oh, my God, there's been a plane crash, blah, blah, blah. And then someone then shouts from the other end of the newsroom, because they're all, you know, on their Twitter to find out, oh, don't worry, no one was on it.
Right? Yeah.
There were 221 people on it. But no Kanye one. West or, no. Or yeah, I don't know, Taylor Swift wasn't on it. You go, oh, so those people, they're no one.
Well, it's also true, like, particularly from an Australian perspective, big things can happen similar to like plane accidents, and we won't report on it unless an Australian, or if we do report on it, we go, no Australians were on board. Like we always report it from the perspective of like, will it affect us? Can we put a face to this kind of tragedy? And it's the same as like, you know, a lot of people always say, well, why don't we, you know, talk about what's happening in Ukraine now so much, or what's happening in the African countries. I mean, the African countries are just, it's abhorrent what's happening to a lot of people over there, and we don't talk about it, and it's like they're not the same coloured skin as us. And I think news is based on what we want to consume, is based on how we see ourselves. So we only will relate to it if we see ourselves in that story, or if we know of someone who might be Australian.
I think there's been a significant change in my lifetime that frankly terrifies me, and I wouldn't mind your view on this, where the line between entertainment and news has been obliterated.
Oh, 100%. And it's sad. And a lot of journalists, I mean, myself included, become opinion people. I mean, I quite often will go on TV and have an opinion on something. But I also am not an investigative journalist. I don't take myself too seriously. I mean, I am a radio journalist and I take that very seriously. But I do think the line has been blurred between journalism and people who want to be famous or want to be known as someone who has an opinion.
But also beyond the opinion, there's something where, like, how you watch Desperate Housewives, was that the show?
Oh, Real Housewives.
Real Housewives, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You watch that to sort of turn off and be entertained and whatever else. There are millions of people, and I'm not blaming them, it's how it's served up to them, who watch the news as entertainment.
Yes.
So not to be informed. So it's a bit like Anchorman is no longer parody.
No, it's actually real. No, and I agree with that. Also, social media has really changed the concept of news and how people consume it. And it's also made it quite divisive. And Trump did no favors for journalists and, you know, labeling fake media. But then the media did themselves no favors by never accepting that maybe he might have been right on a few things and challenging him on the things that he wasn't. Media has lost that. They've lost people's ability to believe that what they're hearing is true.
And also any capability to understand a nuance.
Yeah, the problem is right now with social media, there is no such thing as a nuanced argument. Everything is you're either with me or you're against me. And if you're not with me, then I will not listen to anything you say. Whereas, and I've tried a lot, I don't go on formerly known as Twitter, X, much anymore. I mean, I do go on it a lot because I have to for work. That's where I get a lot of my breaking news. But I don't engage with it because it's become this whole sad, divisive, you're against me, not with me kind of thing. It's like we're going back into tribes. It's become really tribal. We're losing that ability to compromise and work things out, even in politics, in real life, on social media. It's become quite toxic.
My brother calls it PLUs. It's people like us. So what many people are doing, and again, it's entertainment, not news, is they're playing to their tribe.
Yes, it's all tribalism.
So I'm saying this because I know the people who think what I think and do what I think will go give me a round of applause. And the people who I'm going to upset and pretend I'm empathizing with, but really I'm condescending to, I don't mind. And you go, well, in the olden days, that would be a show rather than the news or a serious column.
Yes, but like, you know, there are people that, like, in Australia, Andrew Bolt, people find him really divisive. But there are times where I watch him or listen to him and he makes very valid points and he's incredibly articulate. There's a whole bevy of people that I listen to and watch that people are like, oh, no, that's terrible. But, like, I think that we need to listen and read more things that we don't agree with to kind of help us formulate the reason why someone else doesn't think the way we do.
That there was a, I'm not sure if it's even printed anymore, that in the UK there was a weekly periodical called The Week.
Yes.
And it had two double page spreads to start with, just sensational, where it would have what they said, and it would be The Guardian on an issue, any issue, right? What they said, and it would be The Telegraph, which is in the UK is a broadsheet, not a tabloid, and then what we think.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, oh, you're actually presenting me.
Yeah.
So I read The Guardian, I read The Australian, I read the ABC.
I read everything.
Yeah.
And
you go, how can this be the same? How can this be the same news event? Because if I just read that paper, I would have got a completely screwed. I mean, obviously, not many people are like you and in the news. You choose the ones you like to read and you read them.
I mean, the benefit of radio news is there are no sides because you're not pontificating and you're not really, you're literally just delivering news. You're literally delivering what someone said or what has happened or police are here at this car accident. Do you know what I mean? It's not really like there's no real opportunity. And I try to be quite even-handed. Like if I'm doing a Labor perspective 1 hour, I'll do the Liberal perspective the next hour. So, you know, you kind of like want to give balance. But that's what I love about the radio news. It's like literally this has happened and this is how I'm going to tell you this story.
Tell us, for people who don't know, what is your – summarize your media footprint, your platform.
My platform. Okay, so I read the news nationally on Nova for the Drive show for Ricky Lee, Tim and Joel. So I read around the country. I deliver national news every single day.
Now, you've done that for a while.
Yeah, I've been at Nova for 10 years. And before that, I was at another radio station. But before that, I was an actor. So
tell us about that.
Yeah, so when I was living in, I lived in Canada for 8 years and I was a professional actor. I worked in television and film. While I was over there, I did quite a few things and then I kind of ended up hosting a local community news channel.
Right.
And I realized that I really enjoyed that. So when I came back home, I was like, I would really like to do journalism. So I said to my stepfather, I'd gone through a divorce at this point. So I'd been married. I showed up back in Sydney. I was 31, divorced, working in a restaurant, thinking, what am I doing with my life? And my stepdad said, if you go back to university, we'll pay. He goes, I think you should go back to university. So I was like, okay, what do I want to do? And politics has always been something I've been interested in. So I went back to university and got my undergraduate degree in politics and international relations, and I got my master's in journalism.
In your 30s?
Yeah. So
good on you.
Yeah. So I only became a journalist 13 years ago.
Was the first husband a Canuck?
Yes.
He was. Which city?
Hamilton, Ontario. So we're just outside of Toronto.
Okay.
So he was a teacher. We were so opposite. I got married when I was 24. Like,
tell us about this. Where did you meet him?
So I met him at the University of Western Sydney. He was doing his teaching degree. I was doing my my undergraduate degree in performance theatre at Nepean, when Nepean was like quite where all the good actors kind of graduated. So I was doing my theatre degree and we met, and then I decided to go over to Toronto and work over there, which actually was good. I'd also, previous to this, I was a professional dancer. I had a diploma in contemporary dance, so I'd done that as well for a bit. So then I went into theatre, then I moved over to Toronto and,
Was his family there?
Yeah, he was Canadian. So he was first generation Canadian. His parents were Eastern European, Slovak. Right. So his name was Rastislav. Yeah, and we were married for 6 years.
I love his dad. The dad's the one that paid for the university.
No, my dad paid for my university.
Oh, I thought it was
my stepdad. No, my stepdad. So once I'd got divorced, I came back home and it was really hard because I'd lived over there for 9 years and you could kind of come back and you don't know how to shop in grocery stores. I had a slight Canadian accent. I didn't know anyone in Sydney. I lived in a hostel for like 6 months, then got like a studio apartment and lived there by myself and kind of, you know, worked and went to university.
Looking back, can you see an inflection point where it all went wrong, when he stopped buying me the coffee I like, or when, you know, or just...
Oh, I just think we were young. I mean, we had agreed kind of that we would come back to Australia. And I think that idea slowly dissipated. And I think that's when I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life in Toronto. It's like Canada's cold. And when you go, like I live in Bondi. I like a beach. I like heat. I just didn't see the rest of my life being there.
The role of location fascinates me.
Yeah. So just pretend. Some people can give it up. I can't.
Yeah, but just pretend Rasik had said, do you know what? I'm going to come back to Bondi. Sliding Doors, you might still be with Rasik.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
Maybe.
But like also 24 is like, the person I was at 24 is a whole different person to the person I am right now. And I think I kind of needed to go through a divorce and a separation and come back home and be on my own and go to university and do all that kind of stuff to kind of work out who I was.
We are moving to the third choice.
What's third?
It's always the song which gets added to a Spotify playlist, which is now 7 hours long and sensational because your song is different to Julia Gillard's.
I bet mine would be so different.
Well, so you've chosen the 2009 remix of Stateless's 2007 song Bloodstream. I think I might have inhaled you. I can feel you behind my eyes. Into my bloodstream. I could feel you flowing in me.
The first time I heard the song, so my current husband used to be a DJ. So I met him, he used to DJ in a club. Anyway, he used to do quite a few house parties and he used to play this song. And there's something about this song when you hear it. It really does. It's beautiful. It's haunting. The remix just gives it that little bit of kick. But every time he'd put it on, I would say to him, "I'm going to marry you to this song. This is going to be our first dance." Like very early on, I was very clear about how I felt about him.
So he said to the doorman, "Could you not let that woman in?"
Oh my god, he totally did. Like he did at one point. He was very scared of me at one point because I kept going up to him after we first met. I said, "We're going to be together," and I've never done this before in my life. But I just knew from the moment I met him that we were going to be together. And so this song was, it always had that feeling for me. And so it was our first dance.
So you can't just leave that there. what was Ethan with anyone else when you were stalking him?
No. Well, the first time I met him, he was living with someone. But I didn't know that.
Okay.
He was living with someone. They'd been together for 8 years. And he met me. And I didn't know this, but he went home and broke up with her after meeting me. So look, I mean, you know, it was both sides.
So this is like passive smoking. You're a passive homewrecker.
I'm a passive homewrecker. I didn't intentionally mean to break that girl's heart, but I'm sorry. But it worked out for me.
And have we done the M word?
We're married.
Okay.
Yeah. We had my son first, Bae, and then we got married.
But how do you spell Bae?
B-A-E. And it's not because everyone likes to think it's Bay as in my Bay, like before anyone else, which is a Pharrell song. But it's actually a Vietnamese name.
Oh.
My husband's not Vietnamese. That's the second thing people ask. Bay in Vietnamese means inspiration. So Vietnam was the first overseas trip my husband and I took together, and he asked me to move in with him there.
Right.
Bay in Welsh means by the sea, and we live by the sea. And Bay is a kind of horse, and we got knocked up after the Newcastle races. So it kind of has this multi-dimensional meaning. It was interesting when we found out we were having a boy. I remember sitting in the room and I picked up a book, and it was a book of names in the room, and I opened it up and that was the name that was there. And then it had all these meanings. So it was like meant to be.
And how did you find, I've got four myself, how did you find motherhood? Or do you find it? I mean, you're in the trenches.
Yeah, I mean, motherhood is probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. And it was one of those things that I never expected to do. I was never, you know, I kind of came from, you know, pretty poor upbringing. My father died when I was young and my mum was a bit of a narcissist, and we grew up very poor, lived in a caravan, then housing commission in Wagga. So, you know, I didn't really have family. I didn't really understand the concept of family. And I think that's what was really challenging for me the most about motherhood and parenthood, is because I was never given the tools on how to relate in certain ways, it's been a massive learning curve.
Have you got siblings?
No. So it's always just been me.
You're an only child who's got an only child. And so tell us about, your poor old dad died early. What happened?
Interesting story. So he was, apparently he was part of the King's Cross Mafia. My mum said he could sell ice to Eskimos. He was a con man. Mm-hmm. He used to swindle money out of old people. So not a very nice person. He was running from the cops and went to jump from one balcony to another and fell.
Bloody hell. Well, there's a story. And how old were you?
I was 5.
Oh.
Yes. So my parents weren't living together at the time because he was also quite a bit abusive. But yeah, I was 5. And then when my mum told me that he died, I stopped talking for 6 months. I didn't say a word. Oh. My stepdad, I adore. So she got remarried and he's kind of been in the picture for over 20 years, 30 years, I think. But he's incredible. He's an incredible support system and he's just a beautiful human.
He's the university man. I like
him. He's the one who wanted me to go to university and he's like, he's just great. It's growing up in that kind of environment. You don't realize that it was bad until you become a parent and go, well, hang on a minute. You can be nice to a little human. You know what I mean? And I like being a parent, especially to a boy. I think raising young boys is incredibly important in this day and age, particularly, you know, with violence against women and all that kind of stuff, and making sure that they are emotionally aware and understand what shame and anger and all of those feelings are, so they don't lash out and they don't blame other people. But being a parent to that boy is probably one of the most important things I've ever done.
Hmm. There's a real challenge for society because I agree with you wholeheartedly. Is we need to bring up boys to be, you know, potentially a different type of man than maybe in the past. But not to do that in a way that just makes them feel worthless.
I think we have to be really careful with how we pit girls and boys against each other as well from a young age. And we need to be really cautious because girls, I'm seeing it right now, they're quite manipulative. I mean, we are manipulative. We are manipulative humans. Let's be real.
So I think adults have a real responsibility where obviously, you know, society is always a work in progress. But to lift our eyes to the heavens where the idea is to do what's best for everybody.
Yes,
not a particular gender or age or race or demographic to win and someone else to lose. You go, let's try and work on making everything better.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, like, you know, when you talk about the gender pay gap and all that kind of stuff and quotas as well, particularly in politics. I don't think we should be focusing on things like that. I think there are other ways that we can achieve those outcomes that without kind of saying that we have to do it through this kind of set kind of paradigm. Like we can achieve quotas and we can achieve that by, for example, you know, if the government made it so it was cheaper for kids to go to daycare, then women would be able to get back into the workforce. And then, you know, that's where that kind of pay parity, that's where they're going to get more positions of power in the workforce. Because, you know, let's be honest, we have to take time out of our careers. It's just a fact. We lose superannuation. I mean, the largest cohort of homelessness is women over 55 because they have no money because they were married and then they got divorced and then they have no superannuation. They have no reliable skills because they've been raising children. So I think that's the way that we achieve the things that we want to achieve when it comes to gender parity.
I probably shouldn't tell this story, but my gorgeous, gorgeous granny, so my mum's mum, to the day she died, would write to my wife, Kate, and it would be addressed Mrs. Nigel Marsh.
See, isn't that so random?
So the last name thing I get, it doesn't mean I'm happy for anyone to do whatever they want, but I can understand logically why if two people join, you might say, let's choose one, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm not voting for either side. But why would she be called Nigel?
Yeah,
I know. It's just like, no, dear old Granny Vi.
Very old school.
You know, just contextual. You go, well, that's what used to happen.
Yeah.
You know, but literally a letter would arrive and I would open all her mail by mistake because you go, well, obviously it's for me because it says Nigel Marshall.
Well, I didn't even change my last name when I got married.
Right.
Like I've kept my name. Also, coincidentally, my name is Michelle Stevenson. If you Google it, I don't know if you Googled it.
I did, but going.
Did you see that I'm a Spice Girl, a former Spice
Girl? Yes, yes, yes. I thought, woo!
I'm not. I hate to break it to everyone, I'm not. But for the last, I would say, ever since the Spice Girls became famous, what's that, 25 years, whatever, even to this day, I receive invites, like the Sun, in London Sun will send me messages. I always get asked to appear on television shows. I always get asked to do things. So before they became famous, Michelle Stevenson was part of the original Spice Girls, and then she dropped out and Emma Baby Spice took her spot and they became famous. So everyone thinks I'm that Michelle Stevenson. And what's happened is Wikipedia has morphed the two of us. So my photos are there.
We have exactly. I've got a Nigel Marsh who's an underwater photographer.
Right.
So I've been introduced at conferences.
Yes.
Where the person. It's quite embarrassing when they introduce, because obviously they pump up your tyres and they're going on about some of the things I've done and you know, exaggerating how wonderful they are. And they go, and on top of that.
Yes.
He's
an underwater photographer.
And you go.
I know. Well, I quite often, like at least twice a year, there's an article about the forgotten Spice Girl and they go through my Instagram and take all my photos. Right. And I'm like, that's not me, but sure. Whatever.
You are the Pete Best.
I am.
The- Your fourth choice on Five My Life, it's always the place. You've chosen Splendor in the Grass.
I know. It's a music festival.
Because you keep on stalking the DJs.
No, I have this. It's my happy place. Like a music festival. I went to Coachella last year as well, and it was amazing. I love music festivals. The vibe is always high. No one's ever mad at a music festival. It's always a good time and just seeing incredible live music. And Splendor is like one of those. I mean, I've been going every year for the last 10 years. I think this year was kind of the first year I didn't go. And even then I got extreme FOMO.
So to listeners who don't understand, who are not as trendy and energetic as you, what the hell is Splendor in the Grass?
Okay, it's in the kind of in the Byron hinterland on the east coast of Australia. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so it's a three-day music festival. They always get the biggest acts and some not-so-big acts, which is always really fun as well. I always camp on site because I believe in the true experience of a festival, and also it's just easier because at nighttime when I'm done, I don't have to get on a bus and go 40 minutes back to where I'm staying. I like just camping. And when I say camp, I glamp. Like they have proper showers and there's even a masseuse and we've got proper beds and, you know, it's bougie. There's just a vibe about it. And sometimes I don't even go with friends. I just rock up because I know people and I know that I've got to run into people that I know.
Wow. And whacked out of your brains on drugs?
No. I mean, I used to be.
Right.
I mean, we've all done a music festival and we've been high. I think now there are times where I even go see live music, I don't even drink, because I think you kind of don't experience it or remember it the way you would like to remember it. And I think nowadays most people I know are doing mushroom chocolate. Like I feel like mushrooms have kind of made this kind of weird comeback. People like to do this little microdosing. But for me it's about the music.
So this is a weird coincidence that we're having this conversation now, because yesterday I saw 9 bands back to back.
Really?
At the inaugural Bundanoon Folk Festival.
Oh, was it amazing?
It was orgasmically, euphorically sensational. Mm. Where people I have never heard of.
Yes.
It's so authentic.
Yeah.
It is so intimate. So they're all in different venues, right? So I'm in the, I don't know, the Anglican Uniting Church, because they're using three churches, the Scout Hall, the pub, wherever. So Kate and I, my wife, we'd written down the people we're going to see.
Yeah.
So we run into this church and there's a guy, Galley, he was there standing by himself, and he goes, oh gosh, I'm supposed to be here with my band, but they all got smashed last night, so they don't turn up. So it's me performing, alone, and I hate performing alone. And I'm always very nervous. So I've had 2 pints and I go, hold on, it's 11 in the morning, right? And
you've
got beautiful lilting Irish voice. And he's just got a guitar, no PA.
Yeah.
And he just, it's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And then halfway through, he goes, do you want to sing Amazing Grace? And you think,
amazing.
Well, not really, but we did. And I've teary.
Yeah.
You go, this is the most intimate, live, real, beautiful thing. And it's what it's made me think, a long question, I do apologize. It made me think,
that's okay.
Is sometimes the smaller the better.
Yeah, so I like Blues Fest as well. Like, I took my son. I've been a couple of times before, and we went with friends and we took our kids. And taking your kids to a festival is just heaven. And what's great about Blues Fest, most of those people you don't know during the day. And you're just going to the stages, and they are all phenomenal artists. And just to see your kids really enjoying it. Like, my son was just having the time of his life. And we saw some acts that were just incredible. And it was just heartful moments. I mean, one of my good friends who I hadn't seen in ages, she came with us, and her and I just had this incredible moment watching an artist together, crying and dancing and just going, you know what, this is the best moment of our lives.
And it's the smaller tents. I went.
Yes, the smaller tents are the best.
And apologies to this bloke because he's probably famous, but I was, have you heard of a bloke called Henry Wagons?
No.
So I've seen this guy. I'd never heard of him. It was so ecstatic. He jumped into the audience, right? Mm. And he was singing in the audience. So he's now not on the stage. And then he stops and goes, this is the biggest show business mistake ever, because I have no idea how to get back on stage. And you go, this is fabulous. This is real people just throwing themselves out there.
Well, quite often at Blues Fest, they'll hop off the stage and just walk through the crowds. And it's a lot of fun. And like, I can't think of the artist who I saw, the Scottish artist at this year's Blues Fest, who blew my mind. He was so good that I came back to Sydney and got tickets for his Sydney show to watch him again. And I'd never seen him before or heard his music, and it was just it moved me so much. So like, those moments are just pure joy moments.
That there's something about the creative community who do that.
Mm.
That there's a phrase about being sort of the community of the humbled, where, you know, Jimmy Barnes lovely, Beck lovely, whatever. Mm. I mean, genuinely lovely, got oodles of respect for them. But if you are cracking out a concert at 11 o'clock in the morning in Bundanoon Anglican Church.
Yeah, you love music.
And if you are at Blues Fest and, you know, you're putting yourself out there and you're not a multimillionaire, I just feel like a real sort of connection with them. That they're giving of themselves. It's a pure thing.
And even at Blues Fest, they have the those who have won the busker, like the busker winners, and they're like amazing. They're like these artists who, like, you know, have no money, and they're the ones. Like, if you go see the ones who are on at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, they're sometimes the best. Paolo Nutini was the one I was trying to think of. That's who I saw live, and it was just mind blown. Like, he was the most incredible artist live, and so I saw him again when he was in Sydney. But some of our favorite acts were like when we're sitting around in the shade of a tent because it's hot, and, you know, the kids are running around us, and you've got some artists on, and like literally there's maybe 10 people watching, and then you just go right up to the front and the kids are just dancing, and it's such a moment.
So there's I don't want to get religious on you, but I think there's a really spiritual exchange that goes on between the performer and the audience, because you go, wow, you are basically naked standing on stage giving, you know, we could all laugh or throw tomatoes at you, but we're actually singing Amazing Grace together. Yeah. At 11:30, it's beautiful.
And I think that's why a lot of artists, you know, have issues like with drugs and alcohol and stuff, because a lot of them need that to kind of get them onto that stage. And I know Paolo Nutini has really suffered through drug addiction, but they're artists, right? They're giving the most insecure, troubling parts of themselves to you on a platter every night. So that's got to be hard. I've mad respect for it.
Wow. Fifth and final choice, engagement ring. And I'm assuming this is not the one that Ratchek gave you. It's the one that Ethan gave you. I mean, who knows? Maybe you're about to drop a bombshell on me.
No. I mean, this one was a hard one because, you know, there are things that I have.
Can I see it?
Yes, yeah. And it's not really a...
Thank you. Oh, wow. Okay.
He designed it himself. So
beautiful.
I think why I like it so much was he encapsulated something that I wanted, or that was incredibly me, that I would have probably picked out myself, but he did that. So it was like this understanding that he knew exactly who I was.
Could you describe it?
So it's just a really simple setting, and it's not massive because I'm not a big jewelry person, but it's white gold and it's got a rose gold ring around the diamond, which has little tiny diamonds. But the story of him proposing to, we kind of set our wedding date and he hadn't proposed. So he proposed to me the night before our wedding. So, and it was a joke about between all of our friends about whether he would actually ask me to marry him and whether I would say yes, even though we were all in Byron for the wedding.
Did he take a knee?
He definitely did take a knee. And when he showed me the ring, I was like, that is like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, exactly what I like. Aww. It's me in a ring. So, and look, there are other things that I could have said, you know, that have sentimentality to me, and there are quite a few of them, but I think this encapsulates where I am now and how happy I am with my life.
Oh, beautiful. Just fantastic. Mm. The show is called The Five of My Life, but there actually are six things.
Okay, great.
And the sixth thing is the person. The person you want to hear take the challenge next and why. And I actually chase everyone up. Doesn't mean they say yes, because no one has to. But I actually wrote, I got a reply from Barack Obama's office, you know, because you go, someone you've never heard of in Australia nominated you to take the challenge.
Yes.
So it's an important responsibility.
Oh, my God. I feel like that's really difficult.
Nothing worthwhile is easy.
I know. Like, who would I?
Yeah.
I don't know, because there's so many people I find so interesting. Do I have to do it right now?
Now, on air.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, this is like, oh, my God, this is very stressful.
Good.
I mean, I was already sweating before and now I'm really sweating.
You're aging in front of me.
I know. God damn it, you're making me age.
Have you got one?
I do. And this person, particularly when I was living in Canada, I used to watch his show every night. And he really changed the way people viewed news and the political climate, because he had this show that was incredible. It was funny. It was smart. And he's still doing really incredible work now. And it's Jon Stewart.
Oh, I love Jon Stewart.
One of the most poignant things I would say for people to check out, Jon Stewart did this monologue after September 11th, after the towers went down, because he's a New Yorker. And he did this monologue the very next day on his show, and you can look it up on YouTube. And it's quite heartfelt and quite beautiful about what it meant to be a New Yorker, to watch that kind of unfold in front of you and what it meant to them. Ever since that happened, he's been championing firefighters who, you know, have been getting sick from a lot of the stuff because they went into those buildings as they were crumbling. So, and his show on Apple TV, which, even though it just got cancelled, A Problem with Jon Stewart, is incredible. This man is just fearless, funny, and intelligent.
I adore him.
Mm.
Back to our conversation probably in the first 5 minutes when we were talking about being able to reach across the aisle.
Yeah.
He did something just incredible. He went on, there's a bloke, I'd never heard of him, he's called like Tucker Carlson or something.
Tucker Carlson. Right, we all know Tucker Carlson. Right.
And he, so I was a bit shocked, I hadn't, you know, a bit of a...
He eviscerated him.
But on his show.
Yeah.
So he went on, he had the courage to listen.
And that was very early on. He eviscerated him.
It was, but not in a...
So not this, in a bad way.
This is going to sound contradictory, but he did that and he didn't sneer at him.
No.
He dismantled the
his
content.
Argument.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And you go, and that's a skill.
And he's done it with, I think it was a Republican... Oh, yeah, that's right. It was a pro-choice Republican because the Roe v. Wade stuff. And he dismantled the argument about how you're pro-choice, but you're also like guns, and how many children are being killed at the hands of a gun. And he's like, but if you're pro-choice, wouldn't you be anti-gun? So it was he literally dismantled this man's whole argument in like 5 minutes. And it was just incredible to watch. I think we need more of that. Let's just laugh at ourselves.
Now, I hope that Jon Stewart is one of your fans, because then when I email him and say, oh, it's not Nigel Marsh that wants you on, mate. It's me, Charles Stewart.
Yeah.
But thank you for coming on and respecting the format and being so warm and engaging and entertaining.
Thanks for having me. And I'm so glad that you got to sit through all of my choices.
Michelle Stewart, thank you so much.
Thank you.